Hey, thanks so much for listening to this message. My name is Jason, and I'm one of the ministers here at the Madison Church of Christ. It's our hope and prayer that the teaching you hear today will bless your life and draw you closer to God. If you're ever in the Madison area, we'd love for you to stop by and study the Bible with us on Sundays at 5 p.m. or Wednesdays at 7 p.m. If you have questions about the Bible or want to know more about the Madison Church, you can find us online at madisonchurch.org. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast as well as our sermons podcast, Madison Church of Christ Sermons. Thanks again for stopping by. I hope this study is a blessing to you.
So let's talk a little bit first about the book of Daniel. So the book of Daniel is a very interesting book. It covers the time frame from when Judah was first deported into Babylon until the fall of Babylon. And the Israelites were deported. There were three different deportations. And so Daniel actually went to the first. The hard thing about Daniel, whenever we study or read Daniel, we have to remember that it's not in chronological order. Daniel 1 through 6 kind of describes the events that happened within the palaces and within the city, things like that in Babylon. And then 7 through 12 are visions. But the problem is, when we go and we look at the vision in chapter 7, it talks about that being the first year of the king. But then in chapter 5, Daniel chapter 5, it's the last year. So you always got to remember that the two visions, chapters 7 and 8, actually happened between chapters 4 and 5. So it's a really interesting book. We just got to remember when the order in which things happen. We kind of put it on a timeline, and I know it's probably a little bit difficult for you guys to see, or at least it's hard. It's a little better on the screen than on the TV back there, but in 605 is when Nebuchadnezzar makes Judah's king a vassal king, and he takes mainly just the princes and the noblemen from Judah and carries them back to Babylon. And that included Daniel. So Daniel went right around 605 BC. And then in 586, those in Judah kept uprising, causing problems. And so in 586, Nebuchadnezzar completely destroyed Jerusalem. And of course, carried the rest over. And in 562, Nebuchadnezzar dies. His son Nabonius becomes the king of Babylon. And then in 563, he appoints his son Belshazzar to be co-regent. And then he goes off and travels the world and leaves his son in charge of Babylon. And then we talked a little bit about Cyrus the Great last couple weeks ago. And so in 539, Cyrus the Great, we'll talk a little more about this tonight, he conquers Babylon and kills Belshazzar, and then he lets the Jews, he actually lets every nation that the Babylonians have captured go back to their homeland. But that's kind of covers the book of Daniel. Let's review just a little bit, because it's talked a lot about in Daniel, but let's talk a little bit about what Isaiah prophesied about this everlasting kingdom. So if you remember, Isaiah in chapter 44 talked about this everlasting kingdom. And then he's the one who said Cyrus is going to be the person who's going to release those in exile, and they're going to come back and rebuild Jerusalem. And that was about 150 years before Cyrus ever became king. And so Isaiah talked about this everlasting kingdom. If we remember, the Jews were really upset about this whole idea of being carried over or off into Babylon, because they felt like God had broken the promise that he made to them about always having Daniel, and especially they thought Solomon had created this everlasting kingdom. So let's talk a little bit about this first, when Daniel first gets there, right? We're familiar with the story of Daniel, but if we go to chapter 1 in Daniel, it says, "Then the king commanded his chief eunuch to bring some of the people of Israel both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish, of good appearance and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace and to teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. Chaldeans is also the Babylonians. So when he first comes in, he doesn't take the king of Judah with him. He becomes a vassal or a puppet king, but he does take some nobility. So we do know that Daniel and his friends were in the upper nobility of the Israelites in Judah, and they get carried off with that first group that he takes. Very common practice. What the Babylonians would do is they would pick people who were well educated, looked good, train them or teach them their customs, their culture, then they would use them as anything from advisors to ambassadors, right? But they tried to take the people they conquered and assimilate them very quickly, bring them out of their culture and assimilate them very quickly into their own culture. And so they wound up doing this with Daniel and as well as some of his friends. If we go to verse 7, it says, and the chief eunuchs gave them names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar. Then he renamed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, renamed them from their Hebrew names into Chaldean or Babylonian names. So I don't know why we always refer to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego by the names given to them by the Chaldeans, but we always refer to Daniel as his name, that's his Hebrew name. So I'm not sure why it wind up sticking, but be aware that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that's not their real Hebrew names, but rather those were the names that were given to them by this eunuch in Babylon. So he has friends. So we're going to jump right in. So in chapter 2, the king Nebuchadnezzar, he actually has two dreams. We won't talk too much about the second one. Let's talk about the first one, right? First one we're all familiar with that we read in verse 31 through 35. Well, a little bit before that. If we remember, none of his wise men, none of the ones who give him advice, none of them could interpret the dream. So Nebuchadnezzar said, I'm going to kill them all, right? So Nebuchadnezzar had decreed that all his wise men would be put to death. This included Daniel and his friends. And so Daniel got wind of that, prayed to God. God told him about the dream. And when we pick up in verse 31, Daniel tells the king about his dream, right? If we remember this, let's start kind of in the middle. It says, the head of this image was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its middle and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. And as you look, the stone was cut out by no human hand, and it struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold all together were broken in pieces and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floor, and the wind carried them away so that not a trace of them could be found, but the stone that had struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. So he told him about this dream, what he dreamed, and then he interpreted that dream and told Nebuchadnezzar there'd be these four mighty kingdoms. The Babylonians were gold. Then you'd have the Medo-Persian. Then you would have the Greeks and then the Romans. And at the bottom, what we typically see is the Romans ground over all these empires. So you had that feet and clay. And then that stone that came was Jesus and the establishment of the church. So he explained all this to Nebuchadnezzar. So Nebuchadnezzar then appointed him governor, appointed Daniel, made him a little bit higher in the office. I don't have a slide on it, but if you remember the second dream of Nebuchadnezzar is that he dreamed that he was a tree or a stump, and the stump wound up being bound with chains. And so Daniel told him that he was going to go crazy for a little while. And we remember Nebuchadnezzar kind of lost his mind, and then he came back. So that's that dream. So what we're going to do, we're going to jump to chapter 7. Because you remember, we're going to kind of do it in chronological order. So we're going to go to chapter 7, where Daniel has a vision. And so notice in Daniel chapter 1, it says, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions of his head as he lay in his bed, and he wrote down the dream and told the sum of the matter. So it's that first year. Nebuchadnezzar has died. Nebuchadnezzar has appointed a king. That king has given his son to be co-regent. And it's in that first year of that son, which would have been Nebuchadnezzar's grandson, first year of his reign. Daniel says, verse 9, as I looked, thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames, its wheels were burning fire. Go to verse 10, and a stream of fire issued and came out before him. 1,000 thousands served him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him, and the court sat in judgment, and the books were open. Verse 11, and then, because of the sound of the great words, the horn was speaking, and as I looked, the beast was killed, and his body destroyed, and given over to be burned with fire. So the first part of Daniel's vision, it's almost like he's in a throne room where court, like a king's court, is taking place. And notice that it talks about his clothing was white as snow. What's the symbolism that's given there, right? Is that it's almost God setting court in judgment. And so this first part of the vision, most believe, is him looking at or seeing a judgment that winds up taking place. But then he sees four beasts. Well, before he does that, notice that it says in 13 and 14, and I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the cloud of heavens, there came one like a son of man. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him, and to him was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom, that all people, all nations and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away. His kingdom is one that will not be destroyed. That's one of the reasons we started in Isaiah chapter 44, because Isaiah prophesied about this everlasting kingdom. But I want to spend some time and us talk about this two things. One, he sees this person like a son of man who came out of the clouds of heaven. So let's talk about that son of man a little bit. So in the New Testament, in the Gospels, Adam is referred to as the son of God. Here we have this vision, Daniel has this vision of a son of man. So we have two different things that's talked about in the Bible, a son of God, we have a son of man. So what exactly is going on, and what is Daniel talking about here? So why was Adam in the Bible referred to as a son of God? Because he was created. He had no parents. So oftentimes you'll see Adam referred to as son of God because he was created by God. You'll then see Jesus often referred to as son of man to indicate that he had a fleshly mother, right? And that he was born as we are born as humans. And so the prophecy is very unique because you see him come from the clouds, go to this figure in white, sitting on the throne doing judgment. That figure, who is God, is now going to give the son of man dominion. So even though it says it's a son of man, the idea is that he is man, flesh, but yet he is also associated with deity or God. And so most believe that when you see this son of man, it's to help distinguish that Jesus, you know, if you remember some of the arguments Paul dealt with, you know, Paul dealt with the argument that Jesus wasn't flesh, that he was spirit. And so it's this whole idea of the son of man, who's coming from the ground, from the clouds, is going to be fleshly, is going to be born like we are born, who's going to have a mother, right, a parent. And so it's very unique for us to keep in mind this whole idea of Daniel prophesying about a son of man who comes from the clouds, but yet he will have this kingdom that cannot or will not be destroyed. Then as we're on the talk about the kingdoms, he then has this vision where he sees these four beasts. We're going to go one slide on the four beasts, because we could do a whole class on the four beasts, but we're going to have one slide to kind of walk through what he sees. The first beast that we see in chapter 4, it said the first was like a lion and had eagle wings. And then if you're in verse 4, what you'll see is those eagle wings pop off for a while and then they come back. So most believe that this is talking about the Babylonian Empire. This is Nebuchadnezzar. And when his wings popped off, that's when he went, when the other prophecy. And most of them say it's the Babylonians because their crest was a winged lion. It was actually along the walls of their palaces in their capital. So in verse 4, when they see this beast, was like a lion with eagle wings, most say that's the Babylonian Empire. And then if we move to chapter 5, it says there was another beast, a second one, like a bear, and it talked about that he was on his side. Most think the predominant one is that this is the Medo-Persian Empire. This is where Cyrus, the next in line was Cyrus when he conquered the Babylonians. Their symbol was the bear. The reason it's on its side is most say because the Persian Empire was greater than the Medes. And so it signifies that the Persians were a little bit bigger empire. Then in verse 6, it says, "And after this I looked, and behold, another like a leopard with four wings of a bird on its back." So this is the Greek Macedonian. This is Alexander the Great. If you know any history about Alexander the Great, you know he conquered and rose to power very quickly, as fast as a leopard would run. But he had no heirs. So when he died, his kingdom was divided among his four generals. And so many say that this beast represents the Greeks. And then in verse 7 and 8, it says, "After this, I saw in the night vision, and behold, a fourth beast, terrifying and dreadful and exceedingly strong." And so most believe this is the Roman Empire. Now, there's a lot of detail in these that we're leaving out. I will tell you, not everyone agrees with this. Some break out the Medes into their own empire. And so they would say chapter 7, verse 5, was talking about the Medes. Verse 6, we'd be talking about the Persians. And 7 and 8, we're talking about the Greeks. Some say that they don't represent any specific kingdoms, but just talk about kingdoms of man in general. Mike Baker's opinion, tends to follow what is here on the slide, basically because Daniel really focuses on the time of exile through the coming of Christ and the empire that was in power when Christ was here was the Romans. So for me, I feel like that this is pretty much my opinion as far as each one of these four beasts and who they represent. But Daniel's leading up to that these are all mighty kingdoms in Earth's world history. But then after that last beast that see in verses 7 and 8, there's going to be another kingdom that gets established. And it's going to be, it's going to wind up being an everlasting kingdom. So in the same chapter 7, verse 27, it says, "In the kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. His kingdom shall be an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him." So this kind of replicates, although not exactly, Nebuchadnezzar's dream. It comes very close. It talks about these four great kingdoms. Then that last kingdom, when it goes away, there's going to be an everlasting kingdom that's going to be established by a very righteous people. So this is that first vision that we see in that Daniel has in chapter 7, which remember chronologically occurs between chapters 4 and 5. So let's go from chapter 7 back to chapter 5 for a minute. So this is a story that we all learned as kids, where Belshazzar, by this time though, the Babylonian Empire, it was in pretty bad shape in terms of economically and all this, but Belshazzar wouldn't admit it. He's having a big party, right? He's having a big feast. He actually calls and gets the goblets and the instruments that were taken out of the temple, the Jewish temple, brings them into the feast, and they're using them. They're using them like the everyday dishes, and they're drinking from them. And then if we remember, a hand appears and begins writing things on the wall. And so it's written on the wall. And then if we look at that story, no one can understand or interpret what's being written. And then it says the queen tells him of Daniel. Now, we don't know when it says the queen, if that's his mother or if that's his wife. But somebody reminds him of what Daniel had done with Nebuchadnezzar. Because by this time, Daniel's getting a little old and he's brought in. So you know what he says, or hear what he says in verse 22. And you, his son Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this. Now, before verse 22, he reminded him of what God had done to his father, Nebuchadnezzar. But you have lifted yourself against the Lord of heaven, and the vessels of his house have been brought in before you, and you and your lords, your wives, and your concubines have drunk wine from them. This is where he takes those goblets, he takes those things out of the temple, and he uses them in this party. And you have praised the gods of silver and gold, or of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see or hear or know, but God in whose hand is your breath and whose are all your ways you have not honored. So Daniel interprets what's going on with the handwriting on the wall. Now, what I find is so fascinating about this in Daniel 5 is if you go and you look at world history, while all this is going on, Darius, who's also known as Cyrus's troops have dammed up the Euphrates and diverted the Euphrates River, and they're coming in the riverbed through the bridges into the city undetected. And they actually capture the Babylonians, take over the Babylonians without much of a fight at all. Some historians say there was one battle, but a lot of history says that they gave up relatively easy because by this time no one liked the king anyway. But if you'll notice, if we go back to Isaiah chapter 44, verse 27, when Isaiah is prophesying about Cyrus, Isaiah prophesies that I will dry up your rivers. And if we remember, the way Cyrus took over the capital was he diverted the Euphrates River and then came in through that riverbed. He made that river, the Euphrates that ran through the city, dry up because he diverted it upstream. Daniel 5:30, verse 30 tells us that that very night, the same night that Daniel interprets that vision of that hand or the handwriting on the wall and what it wrote, that very night, Belshazzar, the king, was killed. And just like that, the kingdom of Babylon was gone. So we move from that statue of that head of gold into the next kingdom that's talked about. Now, what we see happening is, it's kind of like if you're, you know, years ago, I came here, I moved into town to work for Intergraph. 9 years ago, 10 years ago, we were bought by a company called Hexagon. Well, to me, it was still the same thing. Had the same job, had the same title, just had that different manager. Same thing happened when Cyrus took over from Babylon. Daniel stayed as an advisor to the king. oftentimes many of those people just stayed in that role they were in. I went to Russia in the early 90s, and I forget, we went to this town, and we were with some people from Rostov University. We went to this town, and as we're talking to the head of the, basically be the head of the Environmental Protection Agency, and he kind of leaned over and he goes, he did the same thing when he was a communist. And so he stayed in the same position. The government changed, but he stayed in the same role. Same thing happened with Daniel, because it's under Cyrus that Daniel gets thrown into the lion's den. So there's a switch between those kingdoms. So Daniel served both kingdoms. So now, because of time, we're going to kind of jump through and drop down to chapter 9. And so it says, in the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, perceived in the books of the number of years that according to the word to Jeremiah the prophet must pass before the end of the desolations of Jerusalem, namely 70 years. In the first reign of who? First reign of Cyrus. So in that first reign, Daniel is reading the word Jeremiah the prophet, or maybe he remembered the words from Jeremiah the prophet. But Daniel puts together that Jeremiah prophesied it would be 70 years, and then they'd be able to return home. At this time, Daniel is 66 to 67, and so he realizes it's very close to where they'll be able to go, or some remnant will be able to go back to Jerusalem. And so you see him break down in verse 13, where he starts this prayer. We studied prayer a couple quarters ago. We actually kind of included this, where Daniel basically in 15 confessed and asked for forgiveness for the people, because Daniel realized that the reason they were in exile is not because God had forgotten them or forsaken them, but rather they had turned their back from God and from the things that Moses had told them, and that we had sinned. You see that last part of verse 15, we have sinned and we have done wickedly. And so Daniel, in verse 19, says, pay attention to act, delay not for your own sake, because your city and your people are called by your name. So Daniel makes this prayer on behalf of the people. And notice in verse 21, it says, Daniel says, as I was speaking in prayer, the man Gabriel, the angel Gabriel, whom I had seen in the vision at the first. So if we go back in, we didn't mention this, but if you go back to chapter 7, where he sees that court taking place, Daniel goes up to one of the angels and asks him what's going on. And Gabriel was the angel that answered him and told him about the judgment. So here we see that even while he was still praying, Gabriel came to him in a swift flight at the time of the evening sacrifice. And then Gabriel explains this whole idea of everlasting righteousness, that it's going to be coming in this kingdom, as well as an anointed one. But he tells Daniel it's not going to be immediately. And if you keep reading in that book of Daniel, it actually talks about there's a 7 times 70 days, but they're not really days. So in the Hebrew, if we went back and looked, instead of being days, it's actually years. So the angel tells Daniel that in 490 years is when Messiah, or when the Christ, will come. And what we see, if you actually add up all the numbers and the dates, Daniel predicts when Christ would be born and when he would be crucified. But you got to understand that oftentimes in the Hebrew language, that day could actually mean a day, or it could be a year, depending upon the Hebrew word that gets used. But Daniel predicts both when the Messiah is going to roughly be born and when he's going to wind up being crucified. And then notice what he says in verse 2. And many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt. So toward the end of Daniel, Daniel starts, his prophecy includes this whole idea of this final judgment, where those who are asleep, those who have died, that they will raise, and they'll either have everlasting life, or some will be everlasting contempt. So Daniel talks about this righteousness, talks about this judgment. And then it says that those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the sky above, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. And then Daniel ends. And then we pick up, chronologically, we pick up in the book of Ezra. So in Ezra chapter 1, verse 1, it says, in the first year of Cyrus, the king of Persia, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom and also put it in writing. Thus says Cyrus, the king of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kings of the earth. He has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever is among you or of all his people, may his God be with him, and let him go to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and rebuild the house of the Lord, the God of Israel. He is the God who is in Jerusalem, and let each survivor in whatever place he sojourns be assisted by the men of his place with silver and gold, with goods and with beasts, besides freewill offerings for the house of God that is in Jerusalem. So notice, Ezra says, in the first year of his reign. That's what Daniel, same thing Daniel said when he talked about Jeremiah, figured out 70 years in the first year of his reign. So Cyrus the Great, king of Persia, God stirred him to let the Israelites go back to Jerusalem and build that temple. And not only did he allow them to go back and build the temple, he also funded it. He provided a lot of funds. He provided and told those who were around to give them plenty of help. But that was his decree. So that's kind of where we're going to stop in the Old Testament. Now we're going to pick up and see where those are fulfilled in the New Testament. Next week, we'll actually talk a lot about that rebuilding of that temple and how the minor prophets prophesied that there would be another temple coming, which would be their predictions and prophecies about Jesus. So let's go back to the New Testament. Let's start in Mark 2, verse 1 and 12. Story we all know. It's the story where Jesus is in a very crowded house, and a paralytic and his friends bring a paralytic to him and then lower him through the roof. So they lower him through the roof, and everybody's watching Jesus. And if we remember the story, Jesus didn't tell him at first that you were healed. Rather, he forgave him of his sins. Because Jesus knew that the paralytic needed spiritual healing much more than physical healing. So that started in a conversation or an argument between him and the Pharisees. And so Jesus, if we remember, Jesus said, well, what do you think is easier, for me to forgive sins or for me to heal them? And I can do both. And then we wind up knowing that Jesus healed. But look at verse 10. But that you may know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins, he said to the paralytic, that's when he said, arise and take your bed. So in Mark 10, 2, verse 10, is when Jesus makes this identification as the Son of Man, symbolizing that he is of flesh, but yet he is also has all authority that's given to him, which is exactly what Daniel saw when he saw the Son of Man go before God on the throne and be given all authority. Then if you notice in Mark 8, verse 31, and he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. So we see in verse 31 that he talks about the Son of Man but he's fulfilling the prophecy that's made by Isaiah. Because Isaiah talked about that the servant would suffer. And then in Mark 13, verse 26, and then they will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and great glory. If we remember, going back to what Daniel said, he's going to see the Son of Man coming from the clouds and then be given all this authority. Daniel, that's what we saw in Daniel 7, verse 13. And the clouds of heaven, there came one like the Son of Man, who came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. That Ancient of Days is God, dressed in white on the throne within that court. And then in Mark 14, verse 62, and Jesus said, I am, and you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven. And we wind up seeing how this gets, once again, this is this whole idea of having that authority. But that notion of Son of Man is very important, because you have to believe that Jesus was a man, that he was human, that he was of flesh. And so time and time again, when we see that phrase, Son of Man, that indicates a human fleshly being. Not where Adam is called Son of God because Adam was created, but rather Jesus is referred to as the Son of Man. In Acts 1, 9 through 11, where the Son of Man ascends into heaven, notice that it says, toward the end it says, this Jesus who was taken up from you into heaven will come in the same way as you saw him go into heaven. So let's go look at Hebrews. So if you'll notice, hopefully you've noticed through the quarter that we go to Hebrews quite a lot. And that's because Hebrews is written to the Jews. And it's an argument about the prophecies in the Old Testament and how they've been fulfilled. And the new covenant is much better. So if you look at Hebrews chapter 2, verses 6 through 8, it has been testified somewhere, what is man that you are mindful of him, or the son of man that you care for him? You've made him for a little while lower than the angels. You've crowned him with glory and honor, putting everything in subjection under his feet. So we see once again that whole idea of son of man. And it says you've made him lower than the angels, simply meaning that he went from a spiritual being into a fleshly being. Hebrews 2, 17, 18. Therefore, he had to be made like his brothers in every respect, so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in the service of God to make propitiation for the sins of the people. For because he himself has suffered when tempted, he is able to help those who are being tempted. So there's this whole argument about that Jesus was flesh and blood, and he was the Son of Man. And now, on our time, let's talk a little bit about this whole idea of living in exile. Because I think we talked last week about how there were many benefits and good that came out of the Israelites being put into exile. We talked about how the Old Testament is a pattern for many things. And I think this whole idea of the exile applies to us today. So let's look at 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 11 and 12. Behold, beloved, I urge you as sojourners and exiles to abstain from the passions of the flesh, which wage war against your soul. Keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and be glorified. Glorify God on the day of the visitation. So let's close with a couple of takeaways that apply to us today. And let's look at this verse, and let's look at three parts of it. First is that Peter tells us that this is not our home, that we are in exile, that we are exile. If you think about what we've talked about in Daniel, you had the Israelites, those who were promised a land, but because they did not keep God's commandment, they were exiled into Babylon. But if you look at the life of Daniel, if you look at his friends Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, what you'll notice is they might have been assimilated into the learning, but they weren't assimilated into that way of life. That Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, even though they were exiled in a foreign land, they didn't act like the people. They didn't act like the Babylonians. They set an example for the Babylonians. They influenced many of the Babylonians. And so as we look at 1 Peter, I think one of the reasons we look at that exile in the Old Testament is because that is a pattern on how we should live in exile today. That this is not our home. We are sojourners. We are in exile. But just as Daniel's friends did, we need to abstain from the culture and the things that are going on in the world that we're exiled in. And how do we do that? Notice two things. First, it says, abstain from the passions of the flesh, which wage war against your soul. So while we're in exile, there's a war going on for our souls, and we're to abstain from those passions of the flesh. Just like, what's the famous story we know about Daniel, Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego? Is they abstained from the rich food that was being served in the king's court, and they asked for a different food. And the second thing it says, keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation. Go back and read. So imagine Daniel, King Nebuchadnezzar says, we know in this dream I was a stump. And then I got bound by chains. What does that mean? Imagine Daniel having to tell the king, well, that means you're going to go crazy. You're going to howl at the moon. You're going to eat grass. I would think that would be very difficult for him. But notice when Daniel tells him the truth, is Daniel thrown in prison or is Daniel given more authority? Whenever we read in the book of Daniel, when Daniel answers truthfully, interprets these dreams, which in a way are kind of not really great for who he's interpreting to, he always winds up being elevated rather than punished. So when we look at 1 Peter tells us that even though we are exiled in a land that's not our home, we still have to be honorable with our conduct. Our conduct should always reflect back to God and give him the glory. And I don't know about you, but oftentimes in my workspace, my workplace, when I've spoken up or something has occurred where I've held to principles, I've held to those things, it's often turned out for good, even though I was dreading having to say something. And so I think when we look at what we see in the Old Testament, it all goes back to what I said the first week. We often do a disservice to ourselves by putting the Old Testament over on this shelf and putting the New Testament over on this shelf, because it's all the Bible. And that Old Testament, those examples, those stories that we read as kids in the Old Testament, those are examples and patterns for us within our Christian life. And so what I want to close with, kind of your action items and things that you take away, is think about 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 11 and 12. How do we conduct ourselves as exiles? How do we conduct ourselves as sojourners in a foreign land? How do we make sure we show that those good deeds and glorify God? All right, so for next week, We're actually going to move into the Minor Prophets. And so Ezra chapter 3, verses 8 through 13, Haggai chapter 2, verses 1 through 9, and then Zechariah 9 through 16. Quick fun fact. You guys already know, because I told you this when we talked about Isaiah. Isaiah is the most quoted Old Testament book in the New Testament. Zechariah is the second. And so there's a lot of quotations in that in the New Testament. All right, have a good rest of the week, and we'll see you on Sunday.